I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver. This is the commentary.ca. Charles Wilkins joins me now. He is the author of a new book, The Wild Ride, A History of the Northwest Mounted Police, 1873 to 1904. It's an epic book about one of the most combative periods in the history of Canada, not to mention North America. It is a brilliantly illustrated history of the Canadian West and the forerunner to the RCMP. Mr. Wilkins takes us from the time just after Confederation to the Red River Rebellion, the Gold Rush, and more. It's beautifully photographed and just a great resource. Charles Wilkins has written 15 books, and he's won several magazine awards, as well as his previous books have been finalists for the Rogers Nonfiction Prize, the Trillium Award, the Stephen Leacock Award, and the Toronto Book Award. The book is published by Stanton, Atkins, and Dossal Publishers. Please welcome to the Plant on Land program, Charles Wilkins. Good morning, Mr. Wilkins.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very well, yourself.
Good. I'm all right, thank you.
Now, you write in the book, in the first part of the book, quote, "No person or institution contributed more to the transformation of the territory than a few hundred men in red coats."
That is true.
Yeah.
And you know, it wasn't that there weren't many others involved. I mean, there were. It was a huge panoramic theatrical period in the history of the West. That period from Confederation through to the beginning of the 20th century. And Joe, when I'm not a historian, really. I'm a storyteller, or I'm presumptuous enough to think of myself as one. So when this project was presented to me, my first instinct was, no, I can't do it. You need somebody who knows history here. But then it occurred to me that maybe I could reverse some of those grade 12 history classes that I'd snored through and teach myself something about my own country. And on looking into the material, I realized that it was very much a job for a storyteller, so I got going. And one of the things that made it so compelling for me was that little 30-year period before the beginning of the 20th century is probably the most intense period of foment and change in the whole history of Canada. I mean, we think of rapid change now, but it's technological change. Those 30 years literally changed the landscape itself, the land, the geography, the map. Prior to that, you know, the Canadian West had been a vast primeval wilderness of forest and prairie, and populated by the tribes and by relatively few fur traders and buffalo and moose and deer and bear and woodpeckers and so on. Within 30 years, it had been changed and transformed into a kind of monopoly board, or in computer terms, a motherboard of towns and cities and municipalities and roads and bridges and farms and telegraph lines and railways and just every imaginable jurisdiction you can think of. The other thing that caught my attention immediately, Joe, was how many really significant historic events or developments had taken place in that little period of time. I mean, you had the transfer of the land itself, the whole of the West, from the Hudson's Bay Company to the government of Canada. You had all the foment of Confederation, the creation of Manitoba and your own province, and a little later Saskatchewan and Alberta. You had the Riel Rebellion in Red River in 1869, and the second Riel Rebellion in 1885, and the trial and hanging of Riel. You had the disappearance of the buffalo, the fall of the last generation of great chiefs, tribal chiefs, the sweeping of the tribes onto reserves, the whole treaty process, which was exhausting and enormous, the gold rush, the coming of the railway through the West. I mean, it was just one thing after another. And these things were not local events. They were merely local events. I mean, they were followed with real fascination throughout the British Empire and North America. So, I mean, And overseeing all this was this little ragtag bunch of 250 to 300 poorly trained, poorly equipped, underpaid, sometimes misfit kind of group of red-coated policemen, the earliest edition of the Northwest Mounted Police.
How did the force, the police force, get formed?
Well, in 1873, there was a terrible event in what is now southern Saskatchewan called the Cypress Hills Massacre. And a little gang of what were called wolfers, American wolfers, and these were guys who trapped wolves, and you know, not in a very humane or sort of ecological way. They put out poison meat on the prairies, and the wolves would eat it, and all other animals would eat it too, of course, including the dogs owned by the various tribal encampments. So everything would die, but they'd take the wolf pelts and sell them back in the U.S. So these guys had come up into southern Saskatchewan near what is now Fort Walsh to Farwell's trading post and were drinking and believed that a group of Assiniboine had stolen their horses and so raided the Assiniboine encampment and murdered dozens of innocent Assiniboine. So the outrage was huge in eastern Canada and the RCMP was immediately formed by the federal government. It had originally been a dream of MacDonald's, but he was out of power at the time, and the Prime Minister was Alexander Mackenzie, who immediately said, okay, let's get the force going. So recruitment begins in southern Ontario. It's very hasty. They get a lot of farm boys. I mean, they want good people, but it's just hard to get them quickly. So they get a lot of teenagers, a lot of older guys, a lot of ex-criminals, guys with various diseases. Some of them had syphilis. Some of them were missing limbs, whatever. And, you know, which didn't equip them well to be cops out on the prairie. So they get them together. The need to get them out to the West is so great that rather than training them properly, they immediately send them up the Great Lakes in October of 1873, and the weather is horrible. It's the kind of, they meet the kind of storms on Lake Superior that 100 years hence would sink the Edmund Fitzgerald. So they get to Prince Arthur's Landing on the north shore of Lake Superior, and you know, they're exhausted, and they're some of them are injured, many of them are sick, they've started to desert, the food is bad. Rather than give them a rest, they are immediately sent on an 800-mile trek through the forest, through the wilderness, along the old Dawson Road toward what is now Winnipeg, the Red River Settlement in that day. En route, they meet blizzards. They have no mitts. They have no hats. They have no proper winter gear. Their tents freeze. They can't put them up. Their boots break up and wear out. The food is terrible. The work is hard. Many of them begin to desert. They're scared. They've heard rumors of the Sioux out further west. Some of them have had their heads shaved so that they're harder to scalp. By the time they get to Red River, a number of them had no boots at all and are walking with rags wrapped around their feet and so on. So this is the state of the forest at that point. They get to Red River and rather... still no rest. They are put to training immediately in the old Upper Fort Garry. And this involves learning to ride, basically, in minus 40-degree temperatures, so 3 months of that. And the horses they're put on are not riding horses. They are broncos brought up from the U.S., untrained, unbroken. So their period of training consists largely of somersaulting through the air and bouncing off the frozen ground. The commissioner at the time, a man named Arthur French, his answer to it all was give them salt to rub into their wounds. They get through to spring, another group joins them, and they begin what is called the Great March West, which is... you know, a better-known period of their development, and they are marched across the West to take up their various posts and positions and build their forts and so on. But this is another degree of farce because they meet dust storms and the drought. They're marching under conditions of drought. The horses they have with them die, mostly anyway. It was just a frightful period of turmoil. They finally get out west and begin as best they can to round up the whiskey traders and all of that. So anyway, the Great March West was not just a march across the prairies to places such as Calgary and Edmonton. It began in southern Ontario.
You mentioned that you're not a historian. So how did you come to write this book?
How did I do it, you mean?
No, how were you chosen, I guess, or how did you decide to write the book?
Well, I was invited to write it by the publisher, who appreciated some of my other work and thought that I was the right kind of guy to do the job, Joe.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm hoping I was. There were other good people involved, and as you pointed out, it's a very lavishly illustrated book. The design is great, and it Roberto Da Silva, the designer, took about a year to round up all those photos and illustrations and posters and so on.
It just looks really nice.
It's unbelievable,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. The photographs, say, of the binoculars, the uniforms, and these little things, were they done especially for the book? Or?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Roberto did all of that especially for the book, yeah. I was going to point out to you, Joe, earlier, one of the great ironies of that Great March West, mm-hmm, was that the Métis, who later became, you know, indirectly at least, the enemy of the RCMP. The RCMP fought them directly at Batoche in the Riel Rebellion of 1885, and really the RCMP were sent out there to keep the tribes in order and keep the Métis kind of in check. But had it not been for the Métis, these brilliant Métis guides and scouts during the earliest period of the trek west, the RCMP, those early RCMP constables and officers, would not have survived, because the Métis taught them on the trek west, taught them how to hunt, how to trap, how to light a fire in the rain, how to get rid of the lice that constantly infested their clothing. They would put the clothing on an anthill, and the ants would eat the lice, so type of thing. And also, the Métis taught them how to be cops, which is amazing in that they had really no police training. And you can understand some of their duties were ceremonial and so on, but if it came to catching a criminal, it involved tracking across fairly vast areas of land and through forest and so on. And only the Métis could teach them how to track, and which they did, of course. But one of the great Métis guides, the most legendary of the lot, was a guy called Jerry Potts, who, it was said, could stand in the middle of a room, where a crime had taken place, say a murder, mm-hmm, or out in a field where cattle had been stolen or horses. And by concentrating on the atmosphere around him, could in some intuitive way figure out which way the criminal had gone, and would say he's gone that way, and the police would follow, and he was invariably correct. Jerry was what in the day would have been called a half-breed from the northern U.S., had basically grown up with shaman and wolves and so on.
Who are some of the villains that come across in this book?
Well, that's a very, very difficult question, because in some cases the greatest villains were the police themselves and all of the forces of Confederation. Confederation was not a pleasant business in many ways to move out west. MacDonald's vision to move west, and put a country across from across the continent from sea to sea and build a railway and all of that, needless to say, you know, was very difficult for the Métis and the tribes. And the tribes across the West already had it pretty hard in those days. The buffalo had disappeared in part because the American Western settlement had basically wiped them out. The cavalry and the U.S. government had calculated that the best way to keep the natives under control or get rid of them entirely was to kill off the buffalo, and they proceeded to do that. So the natives were not in very good shape, plus the Europeans had brought their diseases, and smallpox really, really swept through the Canadian tribal population in about 1870. So they were not in very good shape. And then along come the forces of Confederation and the surveyors and so on, and pay no attention to the Métis and basically want to push the tribes onto reserves. So, I mean, the question of who are the criminals here, I guess, is a little bit ambiguous. And certainly Riel thought the criminals were the, you know, the Orangemen who came up to spread MacDonald's vision west. And, of course, the MacDonald's people and the Confederation, you know, people who were advancing Confederation believed that Riel was the criminal and his people. So, I mean, you get a lot of this ambiguity. In terms of actual crimes, the first, you know, tough criminals were the American whiskey traders. And, I mean, crimes that we recognize as crimes on the in the criminal code now, the whiskey traders and bootleggers and so on from had come up from the States during the 1860s and were trading liquor to the tribes for buffalo furs. So the first real job was to get rid of them, which of course worked for the tribes in the long run. And you had there was a lot of a lot of conflict between the earliest of the RCMP and various tribesmen and warriors. The case of Almighty Voice was a very significant case. Young native man from the One Arrow Reserve in what is now Saskatchewan killed an RCMP officer, and it wasn't clear whether the RCMP officer had fired first or what, but anyway, one the Almighty Voice was thrown in jail, escaped, killed this officer, and was on, there was a, you know, 19-month manhunt ensued in which he was basically traced and tracked by the local policeman, and they caught up with him finally in a woods, and two more officers were killed, and Almighty Voice was eventually killed. But his crime originally had been that he had slaughtered a cow. And it doesn't seem like much of a crime, but he claimed it was his cow. The RCMP claimed it was the government's cow. And anyway, he shouldn't have killed it without a license, et cetera, et cetera. So it was one of those sort of, you know, ambiguous debates that ended tragically, and whether or not one Almighty Voice can be called a criminal is difficult to decide, you know, more than 100 years after the fact.
Did you find that there's much of a gap? I guess there is a gap in terms of how this history that we should know.
For me, there certainly was, and it's in the details. People have a sort of a broad understanding of, you know, Confederation developing and moving across the country and the railway sort of linking the two coasts and so forth, the east and the west. But it's generally been taught to in the schools as a Confederation has been taught as a sort of a, you know, an unambiguous kind of force of progress across the country. And what often wasn't delivered to us as kids in high school, say, was the fact that it was a very, very complicated business, and that many people suffered along the way, and that the price of making a country and MacDonald's original vision was extremely costly. And as I guess all great sort of colonial visions were. What I've tried to do, Joe, is show the that period of history from the point of view of these rather innocent and naive and ill-equipped cops, what they saw, what they felt. I mean, you know, they were in many cases naive sort of handmaidens, if you will, of Confederation. And to show it from the point of view of the tribes and the great chiefs and Riel, the Métis, and also from MacDonald's point of view, because, you know, no matter what one thinks of him, I mean, he was a calculating, hard-drinking, manipulative guy in many ways, but he was also a great genius. And, you know, when I realized the degree to which he had had to push that vision forward against so many odds, I mean, I certainly do have a respect for him, for his capabilities, if not always his ethics. And, you know, he was a product of his time, of course, and wanted to make this country. And whether the country has been a success, it has in many ways, certainly, and with its costs. It's taken the Métis and the tribes 100 years to kind of get back on their feet. But they are now, thanks to people like Riel, who insisted that their rights be respected, and all of that was driven underground for 100 years after the rebellion of 1885 and the hanging of Riel. But it has surfaced again.
Charles, you've done a great service bringing us this complicated part of our history to us in this great book. I've enjoyed the conversation today. Continued good luck with the book.
Well, thanks very much, Joe.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Wild Ride, A History of the Northwest Mounted Police, 1873 to 1904. It's from Stanton, Atkins, and Dossal Publishers. The author, Charles Wilkins, on the line. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.